Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I'm super fantastic, although a bit saddened by the news we got just a while before starting our show here, just a little bit earlier this evening, the news about Steve Jobs.
That's right. I was on the way home from eating out with my family and got the news on my iPhone and then forwarded the news to several friends, including you, Phil, by way of also, of course, the iPhone. So, I guess that's probably a personal first, getting the news of someone's passing on a device they brought to the world.
It's really interesting. I didn't even make that connection. When I got that text from you that I was reading that on my iPhone, imagine how many people got the news of Steve Jobs passing on devices that he was ultimately responsible for bringing to market. That's a profound thought in its own right, isn't it?
Absolutely. And people probably think first of Apple, but I'm a huge fan of Pixar and what they've accomplished, and of course Steve Jobs is a huge part of that as well. So goodbye, Steve, and thanks for everything, you know.
There's a lot to be said about his legacy, and I think we'll talk about that a little bit, but maybe it would be appropriate to hear a few of his own words on what he thought about his life. I think you've got something queued up for us, Stephen.
I sure do. This is Steve Jobs at Stanford.
I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was spending all the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. Sometimes life's going to hit you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. You've got to find what you love. And that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life. And the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. And don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking. Don't settle. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
All right, Phil.
Okay.
That was Steve Jobs at Stanford just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I believe that was 05 when he gave it.
I believe that's right.
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, what can you possibly add? What can you say to that? Live each day as though it were your last, and today ends up being his last. I'll tell you a couple of thoughts as I'm listening to that. First off, quintessential Steve Jobs to be at commencement at Stanford and talking about the beautiful experience he had dropping out of college. Who would have the guts to do that, right? To stand up and do that. That is awesome. That story about taking calligraphy, you think about that. I mean, gets a big laugh when he says, since Windows just copied the Mac, but it's true. The emphasis on typography and design that went into the Mac so changed everything around. That's really what enabled the whole desktop publishing revolution and so much of what we expect in how things look today. And it's just really astounding when you draw that line through time back to this man deciding, you know, he didn't want to go to college anymore, and he would just take whatever classes he wanted to take. It's just it's amazing to make those connections. Not to say we wouldn't have had graphical user interfaces, or that, you know, online typography wouldn't have shown up eventually, but it might not have been embedded in like the first cool visual computer the way it the way it was with the Macintosh. Just makes a huge difference. You know, the other thing I think about when I listen to this is thinking on the passing of Steve Jobs is that we really are not anywhere near post-mortality yet, are we, Stephen?
No. Unfortunately, we're going to lose, a lot more great people, in the coming years. And, to some extent, I think that, you know, this was after Steve Jobs had already been battling cancer.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was one of the very, you know, one of the very few people that had managed to battle into remission. Pancreatic cancer. I mean,
right.
Generally, generally when you get that diagnosis, you just you go say your goodbyes and you're gone. You know, I mean, that's. But apparently, he had a type of pancreatic cancer that that was actually treatable, and so he got a few more years. Anyway, that's it, you know, again, it's sad, but I think he used that experience. He used even that experience to really continue to be living each day and appreciating each day until he's gone. So, that should be an inspiration to all of us, I think.
I think so, too. Well, I wrote about him not too long ago. It doesn't seem like it's been that long ago since he stepped down from Apple. I think it was maybe, about a month and a half ago, roughly.
Right.
Somewhere in August. And what I observed at that time was something that Virginia Pastoreau wrote about, that Steve Jobs made business cool again, right? Here was this guy who is so influential in so many different ways. He's a part of our popular culture in a sense. He's got one of the all-time great business comeback stories ever. He just looms massively. I mean, hugely in the technology realm. He's one of the founding fathers of basically the world we live in today. It's really difficult to overestimate the impact that Apple Computer had and that he had. But the thing that occurred to me was he really did live that motto. He talked about this. This was a guy who at age, he was only 30 years old when he got fired from Apple. The board decided he was out, Scully was in, and that was that. And when you look at what he had accomplished by age 30, that's more than most people will ever do in their entire lives, right? And yet,
right.
That's really just like chapter one of the Steve Jobs story. You know, he goes on, and he founds Next. Next is not this huge business success, but the technology is exactly ultimately what Apple needs to revamp their operating system. And it makes that into his play to get back into Apple and take the helm of Apple back. Along the way, picks up this little graphics movie company called Pixar, which turns out to be $7 billion worth of property, and lands himself a seat on the board of directors of Disney, right? I mean,
put it this way: what other movie production company is actually a box office draw? You know, I mean, when you hear that, I don't know, TriStar, or, some...
You're not going to go see a movie
company
Paramount
comes out with a movie. Is that going to be enough to get you to the theater? I don't think so.
No.
You're going to have to hear who the director was and who the stars are. That's what you care about. But if Pixar makes it, that's far. You can just headline, anything and put Pixar's name on it and people will show up. It's just been like almost everything that Steve Jobs did in his life has just been of higher quality than most of the other stuff. So, you know, it's like you say, it was a way that he got himself into Disney, right? So
yeah, well, exactly, and it's interesting that your question, come to think of it, the only other studio you might answer that question was, well, you'll go see a Disney movie because it's a Disney movie, right?
That's that's true.
Probably the only other studio that that applies to. So, you know, there's not too much more to say other than you can trace the impact that he has had on our world over the last quarter of a century just by the what's been hot, what's been cool, what's been the technology to have. So often over the last 25 years, that has been an Apple product up until, you know, the iPhone 5 coming out here pretty soon, the iPad 2. Before that, you go back a few years and it was the iPod Touch. You go back a few years before that and it was the original iPod. You go back a few years before that, you find the iMac, you know, and all the way back to the Apple IIe, right? I mean, it's from there to here, with a little kind of, I would say, valley right in the 90s before Jobs came back, Apple Computer, that company name, meant like the cool technology, right? It meant the technology that is at the leading edge that everybody wants to have in it, and it means it to this day, and I guess it probably will for some time to come.
Well, let's hope so. You know, and kind of to tell you how embedded this stuff is, you know, Apple is in our culture and everything. You know, our plan for the show tonight was to talk about Apple stuff long before, we heard that Steve Jobs passed away a couple hours ago. So, you know, I mean, we were planning on talking about the new iPhone and what it meant and things like that before that. So.
We have, and in fact, that'll be our next topic. Actually, is talking a little bit about the Knowledge Navigator, but that was our show tonight, as originally planned. And you're absolutely right; it's all about the impact that Apple Computer has had. I would say coincidentally, but it's not coincidental at all because we've talked about this subject many times over the past few years, and it's one that we'll continue to come back to. There's a few people, going back to the early mid 1970s that you can trace so much of the technological landscape that we live in today back to. And Steve Jobs is one of them. You know, Wozniak, obviously his partner, the guy he co-founded Apple with, is another. And if you ever want to hear that, to read that whole story and get the real picture of who these people are, there's a terrific book. I don't know if you've ever read this. It's called Hackers by Stephen Levy.
I have not.
And it talks about Apple, it talks about the Homebrew Computer Club, it talks about the Artificial Intelligence Program at MIT, and, you know, these names of these guys and the sometimes interactions they had with each other, and it really is a great kind of backstory to the world we live in today. But Levy also wrote a book specifically, I believe, about Jobs leaving Apple Computer, which is also an excellent read. Because, you know, he's kind of worthy of his own book. But if you ever get interested in that topic, if you ever want to understand a little bit better about how we got from there to here, there's just a few of these people who were unbelievably influential, who really have, you know, we talk about the world transformed, really have transformed our world. Steve Jobs, definitely one of them. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry, Steven.
No, I agree completely. He is one of the big ones. Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this Knowledge Navigator. Now, you sent me a couple of things on this. Give us the synopsis. What's going on here? Apple Computer made a perfectly accurate prediction of the future. Is that right?
Well, that's one thing. I saw this tweet. I was following this guy on Twitter, and he said, "Hey, look, guys. This Siri that's coming out in the new iPhone 4S that was announced, what was that, just yesterday? that is exactly what the Knowledge Navigator was forecast to be 24 years ago. And so he linked to this video, this YouTube video of the Knowledge Navigator from 24 years ago. And of course, it was a concept. This is where we want to go as Apple computers. We want to have computers that we can interact with like this. Let's put it this way. Siri is going to make your iPhone a totally different machine, according to Apple. It's you say to your iPhone, wake me up tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. It'll say okay, and it'll set the alarm for 6 a.m. And wake you up. You'll say, should I carry an umbrella with me today? And your iPhone will say, well, it looks like about 60% chance of rain. That is what Siri is, that's what they're saying it can do. And, apparently you just have a conversation with your phone and it goes across platforms to different things. You can send a text message. It'll read text messages to you, that kind of thing. To me, Phil, when this thing comes out on October 14, I may have to go get me one, even though that means I'll probably have to pay full price, because if I don't, they'll tack on another 2 years to my already lengthy sentence with my current carrier. And so, anyway, I may have to do it anyway, because it just sounds so cool. And anyway, I guess what we should do is go back and listen to just a piece of that Knowledge Navigator video. And, hope for the best with Siri. Obviously, none of us have had a chance to use Siri, but, hopefully it'll be something like this.
Today, you have a faculty lunch at 12 o'clock. You need to take Kathy to the airport by 2. You have a lecture at 4:15 on deforestation in the Amazon rainforest.
Right. Let me see the lecture notes from last semester. No, that's not enough. I need to review more recent literature. Pull up all the new articles I haven't read yet.
Journal articles only?
Fine.
Your friend Jill Gilbert has published an article about deforestation in the Amazon and its effects on rainfall in the sub-Sahara. It also covers drought's effect on food production in Africa and increasing imports of food.
Contact Jill.
I'm sorry, she's not available right now. I left a message that you had called.
Okay.
Awesome.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what we heard there, and I have some other comments on the Knowledge Navigator video, but that's a terrific little portion that you've got there, because that captures the notion of the dude in the bow tie, right, who's sitting there in the corner of this guy's computer,
the guy in the bow tie, by the way, just beats to death a paperclip.
Yes, he is way better than the paperclip.
By far,
he is absolutely better than the paperclip. Now, here's what we're being given a scenario of in that Apple video. That is the conversational user interface. John Smart talks about that. He's been on our show talking about that as the next major breakthrough technology. And in fact, John says it is the most profound breakthrough that we'll experience, probably, because short of actually hooking in directly, because this is how we communicate with each other. And when we can start having conversations with the machines, we're interacting with them at a much deeper, much richer level than we've ever been able to before. Now, it's impressive what this bow tie dude is doing, right? And what you just said about Siri indicates to me that maybe we're closing in on that. The predictions I've heard from John Smart, is the guy who typically I hear talking about this, is that we would have a true conversational user interface by between 2015 and 2020. So if we've got it now, that's pretty awesome that Apple is that far ahead of the curve. But the idea that you can say, well, I need an umbrella tomorrow, and it's going to parse that, take the content, it's kind of like Watson playing Jeopardy, right? It's going to take enough information from that question to be able to formulate, oh, he's asking about the weather. Let me give a conversational answer back about the weather. In the sequence you played, that, what do you call him? He's an avatar. What is he? That,
yeah,
I
even, look,
that
we
bot,
can call him an avatar.
That,
yeah,
little dude. I don't know what you call the guy. That AI is summarizing his email for him, right? He has read those messages, parsed their meaning, and he's giving him the gist. Now, are they suggesting that Siri will be able to do that?
I don't think that they're suggesting that, but it will read your email to you. It will read your text messages to you. To me, that would be probably one of the neatest features about it. You know, I mean, I get a little bling on my phone while I'm driving down the road. The last thing I need to do is look down and read a text message.
Right.
But if my phone will read it to me,
if I could
say to my phone, read that message to me, that might be pretty cool. And then if I could respond also by just saying, okay, send back a message. You know, I'll meet you at Burger King, or that would be pretty awesome. That'd be great. So, I'm very hopeful and looking forward to this. It's one of the biggest and most profound steps forward, and even something that would be not quite perfect, it could still be a huge step for us. You know, so
yeah. Well, there have been kind of false dawns of voice activated systems for years and years. When I was at US West Advanced Technologies 20 years ago, they put in voice dial phones for all of us, for us to like test this product to see if it was something that the US West actually wanted to roll out. And you know, at that time, the processing of voice commands was all taking place on, you know, big computers on the switch, right? So, I mean, we're talking like mainframe type computers 20 years ago. And even then, you'd be sitting here in your cubicle and you'd hear somebody one cubicle over and she'd be going, call voicemail. And be a few seconds, she'd go, call voicemail. You know, call voicemail. You know, and it's like, plenty of time to have dialed voicemail like six or seven times, but we were all trying to be good sports. You know, we were all trying to make it work. You know, I'd be there, call home. You know, and I'd go, I didn't get that. Did you call home? You know, it was not ready for prime time, obviously, back in those days. But you think that's the 20 year progress from that to what you just described, with all the processing power sitting, in this machine that if you showed somebody an iPhone 20 years ago, they'd have no idea what in the world it was. You know, what is that? Some kind of little portable TV? How does that work? What is that, a trick? And everything you need to accurately and, you know, quickly process human speech and parse it and make meaning out of it sitting in a device that size. It's really pretty astounding to think about it. Well, I want to say a couple things about the Knowledge Navigator video. I've got to put a link up to that. I meant to do that on the Speculous page, and I will put that up there for anyone who hasn't watched it. It's a beautiful piece of art, actually, that video. It's fun to talk about how accurate of a prediction of the future it is. If you're going to grade it, Stephen, you know, on the A to F scale, what do you give it as far as a overall scenario of 2011?
Well, you know, I feel like I should grade on the curve. You know, by comparison to other predictions made, you know, 24 years ago, you got to give that an A. You know?
I think you're right. If we're grading on the curve, it is an A, absolutely. If we're giving it a raw numeric score, I'm going to give it somewhere north of 50%, but somewhere well south of 90. So, I don't know, somewhere in the 60s or 70s, I would say.
I guess we're going to have to check out Siri before we can actually be You know, how good is Siri?
That's the part that's in question.
That's the unknown.
How good is Siri? And that's the big question, actually, isn't it? Because that's the coolest part about the Knowledge Navigator. Other things that are going on in there, we don't even blink to think about what a big deal it was 25 years ago that, you know, this little bot guy would say, oh, yeah, I'm grabbing all the current journal articles on that. You know, 25 years ago, there was no way to do that, right? Oh, here, I'll bring up the map. Let me show you that on a map. Let me just go search all the databases in the world and find you some information. We've had Google around long enough that we don't even think about that as being remarkable. But that was this huge prediction of a coming technology that they got pretty much correct.
Towards the end of the video, in a part that we didn't have the audio for, he's basically doing a Wolfram Alpha thing where it was putting the data together in ways just based on what he's asking at the moment. We finally have that to some extent.
With
Wolfram Alpha.
We're still getting there on pieces of it. I mean, the idea that it's like, here, show me that map, now just overlay what I just said onto it. We're not there yet. You know, that's a combination of the Siri technology and probably having that integrated with lots of different applications and stuff. Although I wouldn't be surprised if there aren't apps that don't come close to that kind of capability right now.
By the way, Siri is integrated right out of the box with Wolfram Alpha.
Cool.
By the way, so.
So you can have conversations with Wolfram Alpha now.
Absolutely.
Something like the I can't remember what it was called. Was he like Mr. Wizard, that Robin Williams character in the movie AI? The vending machine, you'd go put money into it, and then you'd ask it questions, and it would answer your questions, something like that. Now, let me tell you the things that got wrong, okay, in Knowledge Navigator. First off, who would have guessed? 25 years later, deforestation. This video should have been about global warming, right? I mean, the college professor should have been doing research about climate change. Not deforestation is not the cool, you know, hip topic to be talking about anymore. So they kind of missed that. The other thing is, I was actually at the first Macworld Expo where this video was shown, so I got to see this these many years ago, and that was not its premiere. That was not the first time it was ever shown. The first time it was ever shown was at an educational event a few weeks or a few months prior to that. But let me talk a little bit about the audience reaction to that then and the reaction I think people have to watching it now, because I think it's really interesting to consider the contrast between those two. People, you know, just laughed at parts of it. Like when he said, here, I'm searching all the world's databases to find you information, you know, whatever. I mean, this kind of like, I mean, that was just like a laugh out loud joke to people.
How ridiculous is that? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It just, come on. But the biggest laugh of all, the thing that that the audience loved more than anything, got laughter and then a big round of applause, was when he walks up to his desk and he unfolds that device that's sitting on his desk, and it makes that beep sound. That's the beep that the old Mac, the original Mac 64K and the 128K and the 512E up through, I think, about the Plus. If you turned a Macintosh on, that was the sound you heard. And the thing is, when you look at that desk in 1987 eyes, okay, you do not see a computer sitting on that desk. All right.
That's right.
This guy, this guy walks up and there's a book or something there. I'm not sure what that is. You do not think that's a computer. And he opens that and it makes that Macintosh sound, and everybody suddenly realizes, oh, that's his Mac. And it was this, wow, that's so cool. That's so amazing. The idea that a computer could ever look like that. And of course now, here it is, supposedly the year that takes place, and we look at that and we go, well, that's kind of clunky. Right. I mean,
well, it's like an extra thick, you know, it's an iPad that needs to go on a diet, you know.
Yes, it's like a fat iPad. It's a fat iPad with too much like junk around the edges, right? You look at it and you go, oh, this is not nearly sleek enough. This is clunky. It's got a hinge in the middle. What's that all about? Who would want that? You know, we don't want devices that you have to unfold, and the graphical user interface on it. likewise, right? It looks very big and chunky and 1980s. You know, I mean, it looks when you look at the menus and stuff, they're kind of fuzzy and the text is really fat, and that's just a product of you know, you can only see so far into the future, even when you're predicting the future. That device looks really quaint to us in a lot of ways. It looks like something, if it had ever existed at all, other than, you know, what it's capable of doing. It looks like something you would have got about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, something like that is what it looks like. So maybe they undershot
graphical
what,
design.
They undershot hardware design and maybe slightly overshot how far along we'd be with the conversational user interface. But overall, this is a solid B+, if not an A. I got to say, in terms of really capturing an awful lot of where we were going. And the interesting, ironic thing about this, you know, because we start off talking about Steve Jobs tonight, the big proponent of Knowledge Navigator was actually John Sculley.
Yep.
And his commitment to Knowledge Navigator, to that vision, is one of the reasons that he was eventually out. I think, you know, lagging sales probably had more to do with it than that. But that was a vision he wanted to really push, and it was viewed as not being at all realistic by the folks at Apple on the board at the time. And, you know, to their credit, maybe that's right. Maybe a vision that would take 25 years to fulfill is outside of the scope of what you want to be working on if you're trying to make money quarter by quarter. But there's got to be some vindication for John Sculley when he sees people passing this video around and saying, look, it came true, right? Everything they, you know, the things they predicted have now come true in the time period. I don't think we mentioned this. What the video claims is showing us is September of 2011. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And they don't ever actually say the date, but you glean that from you know, some internal stuff in it. He talks about a research paper published 5 years ago, and then it turns out that the research paper was published in 2006. So
right.
And there's, you know, a couple other things that lead you to believe it's September of 2011 in the video. So yeah, that's the time frame. So it's, you know, it's right now, time frame wise. And I think you're exactly right. Overshot it, undershot on design, overshot on capability, but you know, darn close.
That's the difference, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, close that's
enough. may all our predictions of 25 years hence be that good?
Be as good as that.
Yeah, I'd settle for making a prediction half that good. Actually, my hat is off to the folks who made the Knowledge Navigator video, and it's really cool that it was so cool back then, and that it gets to come back and play this interesting role now today. It's like digging something out of a time capsule. My only problem with the whole experience is I can't really get my head around the fact that was 24 years ago.
time flies. You know? I mean,
it really seems like, you know, a couple of years ago I was working at MacGuide magazine, and no, it was actually 2.5 decades ago. So there you have it. Right, as you know, in the eighth grade at the time. That's the weird part. I don't know how I got that job.
you were working for that company when you were in the eighth grade. Okay.
I was precocious. You know me. All right, so what else we got? What else we got to talk about this evening, Stephen?
Well, let's see. How about the real life house made to float with balloons, like the Pixar movie? We can talk about. Let's not talk about that.
That really happened?
Yeah, they really did that.
I think we should talk about that. They did that.
Okay, since I mentioned it, huh? They had to build.
That's
the house.
That's even got a Steve Jobs angle. That was a Pixar movie. There you go.
Exactly. So, you know, so what do we do with this?
I haven't heard this story. I haven't seen a picture, but I've got to say, one of two things is true.
Right?
Either that was a very scaled down and lightweight house.
Okay.
Or they had like a volume of helium balloons that would be equal to like Pike's Peak or something. I mean, it must have just been an unbelievable stack of balloons to pull a house up. So, am I right, or which was it?
Okay, they found that you couldn't use a regular house. There's just no way structurally.
Okay.
It would just absolutely, you know,
the house
would
fall.
Tear up.
Yeah.
house would fall apart, number one. Number two, too heavy.
Yeah.
A normal house would be just too heavy. So basically what they did was they built a, you know, well, you just need to take a look. I'm going to put in the chat room. I'm going to put a link to this right now, okay? And take a look at that house if you like. They built a very small house, and then they used weather balloons, multicolored weather balloons, to make it look like the movie Up, you know.
Oh, okay.
And then they took off and went to 10,000 feet. So I mean, they didn't just do an untethered flight. They went way up with several people in the house, and just enjoyed a nice little flight and returned to Earth safely. So that's a fun story. That would have been a cool trip.
Yeah,
I've been up in a hot air balloon, and I can tell you that's some fun stuff.
Well, you know, I have the Blu-ray of Up, and one of the making of features they actually talked about they wanted to make it as realistic as they possibly could to portray in the movie as close to reality as they could. But one of the drawbacks was, you know, and in the movie it's a huge number of balloons pulling that thing up. So I mean that was kind of satisfying that they, you know, that they didn't just make it like you know, three dozen balloons or something like that. I mean, it looks like hundreds and hundreds of balloons pulling this house up into the air and around the world. But one of the guys said they did the math and it would have just been more than you could fit in the frame, right? It would just have been more balloons than you could possibly show, and you know, in order to lift that amount of weight, so many that it wouldn't look cute and cool anymore. It would just look like strange, right? I guess so.
Well, let me tell you one thing they got wrong, and I know this based on the flying in a hot air balloon. How did he steer it? He put out these little sails on the side of the house, and then he would steer based on the wind and everything.
Yeah.
Why would that not work? And here's why it would not work. When you are in a balloon, you do not feel a breeze ever. You are the breeze.
All right.
You are in the stream, man. You are not feeling air go by you. It can get quite hot because of that when you're in a hot air balloon. So, you know, pick a cool day to go up. But anyway,
good
so,
tip.
Yeah, that, you cannot steer
good ballooning
that.
Tip from Steve. We cover all the topics here on Fast Forward Radio.
That's right. Do not steer a hot air balloon that way.
Hot air balloon.
The way you steer a hot air balloon is that you, while on the ground, you send up a helium balloon, and you watch the helium balloon go up, and you watch the helium balloon go up, and it's going in this direction, and then you'll see it turn at a certain altitude, a different direction. And you go, okay, that's one turn right there, and you watch it a little bit longer with binoculars, and make another turn. And you make note of what altitude you estimate those turns to be at. And then you steer the balloon by going to those altitudes, going up and down to get to those altitudes. And, you know, you go this way a little bit at this altitude. You go up, and you go in a different direction at a different altitude.
And think how much better the movie Up would have been if instead of having those fins on the house, that it just had you come on at the beginning and explain that. And then,
you know, I think there's times that fantasy works better than reality in these
maybe
shows.
So. Perhaps so, yeah.
So, I'm glad they left it the way it is. It's a great movie.
Talk about the difference between a nerd and a geek, right? If they'd gone to have some guy come out and say, well, here's how he's going to move the house. Okay?
Yeah,
this
whole movie sucks. I don't even like the dog because of this. Yeah, they just messed it up for me. Yeah, no. I did not have that reaction at all watching the movie, but
it's a terrific movie, Up. Yeah. And that's cool that they've recreated it's cool that they visually at least recreated the hot air balloon, or excuse me, the helium balloon house transportation system. I love that idea. Hey, we should mention that yesterday was the anniversary of Sputnik. What anniversary would that have been?
When did it go up? 50 what?
7.
57?
So that makes it the 54th. 54th.
54th.
So next year's the big 55.
55, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And that reminds me, October 4th is also my sister's birthday, and I forgot to call her. Ellen, if you're listening, happy birthday. I'll call you after the show.
Happy birthday to my brother. Okay, we got that all. Okay,
yeah. 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 See, you and I.
On the 5th, it's my brother.
We're not nerds. We remember our siblings' birthdays by when Sputnik went up. A day that should always be remembered. That is the day that launched the space race. The day that heated the space race considerably is when Yuri Gagarin went up, the first man in space. But we owe so much to the Russian space program in terms of the impetus it put on the U.S. to accomplish things in space. And I think it's safe to say that no Sputnik, no Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. I think that those two are inextricably linked. And, you know, there are those who would make the argument that, well, maybe things would have worked out a lot better and we'd have had a more rational space program instead of this crazy space race program. But I don't know that we'd ever gone to the moon if we hadn't gone when we went. And I'm not sure when we're going back. I hope soon. But that was a world-changing event. Suddenly, something that was not in space before was in space. No, that had never happened before. And so that was a great accomplishment for humanity, put something in orbit, and a great wake-up call and a great shock to the U.S. because somebody did that and it wasn't us. And, of course, there was not only the national prestige issue there, there was all kinds of defense issues around that. Suddenly we had the high frontier. We had the possibility of hostilities, the possibility of war taking place in space, or space being used to, you know, launch weapons or launch satellites. So, I mean, an awful lot of what happened in the 60s owes back to that date, an amazing moment in human history, one we should always remember.
Absolutely. You know, along those lines, did you catch the anything about the press conference that Elon Musk had about 6 days ago regarding the new reusable rocket that
I read a headline and I said I got to blog about this. He's going to make humanity into an interplanetary species. If tell me the story. I meant to read this and I haven't read it yet. So what can you tell us about it?
Okay, this particular rocket is about half the power of a Saturn V. Every piece of it is reusable, and what we're talking about here is something that you can that'll put stuff in high Earth orbit for about 1/100th the cost per pound of using the space shuttle.
Wow!
And so you know, while we're mourning the space shuttle, let's consider that there might be a better way of doing things. And maybe that's the real reason that the shuttle has retired. It became economically, you know, unfeasible, and we can do it better. And that's you know, something to celebrate. So,
well, I think that's an excellent point. That's really what we should expect, is that when you think how fast we go through permutations of other technology, why would a space launch vehicle technology need to last longer than 30 years? You know, we get new models of cars every year, right? We get new computers. Well, we know that technology is on this outrageous exponential curve. So, old things have to go away. You don't want this big bureaucracy propping up. I mean, imagine if there was some big government bureaucracy propping up old, like, you know, IBM, what were they even called, NT machines, right, or something like that, you know, some kind of floppy disk technology or something like that.
Yeah, if we were depending on, you know, like the National Computer Administration, you know, we'd all still be using Commodore 64s, I guarantee it. So we should be glad that this is becoming a private sector industry, and it's, you know, and another interesting thing. A lot of people are saying, you know, China, you know, they're doing so much, they're out ahead of us now. We'll never catch up. Yada yada. Basically, the same thing we heard, you know, that we'll never catch up to the Russians. You know, I don't think anybody in the world can put you know, stuff in orbit as cheaply as what Musk is saying that he can do with this heavy lifter. Now, you know, we've yet to see it. So, you know, but it would be a very high profile failure if he wasn't able to deliver at least something close to what he's talking about. So,
well, let me just go back to one thing you said. Did you say it would have the same thrust, the same force as a Saturn V?
No, how about half?
Oh, about half. Sorry.
No. It's about half.
How does that rank with the shuttle?
Oh, you know what? I don't even know. I think I think they can actually put more into space with this than with the shuttle.
Okay.
Let's see. Musk told reporters at the National Press Club in Washington that such a system based on SpaceX's existing Falcon 9 rockets would reduce launch costs 100-fold and make possible longer distance missions such as Mars. Now, he's not suggesting, I don't think, that this Falcon 9 takes you to Mars. I think what he's saying is that you can use this to get enough stuff into orbit cheaply.
Well, yeah, I mean that
you can build a spaceship that would take you to Mars and orbit.
Yeah, if it's more powerful than the shuttle, that was that's Zubrin's argument in the case for Mars. In that he talks about using the launch basic launch infrastructure, launch assembly for the shuttle to put the stuff up that we need to get to Mars. You wouldn't actually take the space shuttle itself to Mars, you understand. You'd be taking a completely different craft. But the big solid rocket motors and that big fuel tank and the shuttle engine would have been the driver, the motor that could get you to Mars. And, you know, he explained in great detail in that book, it's a fun book, how that technology could have gotten us to Mars. I remember when I talked to him about that, before we ever had a podcast, the interview I did with him that was just a text interview on the Speculus, he was bemoaning the loss of the Saturn V. Because he was saying, you know, that was really the way to get to Mars, right? It was those big, powerful boosters. So if we've got something that's, you know, working its way back into the Saturn V ballpark, then definitely you've got the thrust capability that might push us, well, get us back to the moon, perhaps, and maybe start pushing us out to the planets. That is really exciting stuff. It's amazing that all these years you think, well, there's no plan, nobody's doing anything, nothing's going to happen, and then things just begin to happen. It's kind of remarkable, really. And Ken mentions the Skylon space plane. That's another one that has been in the news recently. That's the craft, I believe, that'll get you from London to Sydney in 2 hours. You know what's interesting about that is conceptually we've had that idea for a long time. I remember in one of his State of the Union addresses, President Reagan talked about that technology as something that we should be pursuing. So, I mean, it goes back a long way that we've known that was possible. The Concorde has been out of service for how long now? 10 years? When did they
retire
that?
They had that crash on takeoff in Paris, and I think that's been about 10 years ago. And we have not had supersonic transport ever since. And so now, you know, so here's the idea. Basically, you know, you take something that's would be a larger and obviously perhaps more comfortable spaceship two style vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
You take off underneath a like a parent vehicle, perhaps. They take you to high altitude. You get dropped off, and then you shoot into the atmosphere or above the atmosphere. You are not in orbital space, but you're in space. And 2 hours later, you are at any city in the world. You can be in any city in the world in 2 hours flying that way. And, you know, obviously that would be for the very well-heeled traveler.
Yes.
You'd call that the rocket set, I guess. They no longer be jet setters. And, you know, that would be awesome, wouldn't it? I mean, that's the very fact that would be a possibility. You know, why not?
Well, you know, to use the Concorde analogy, it was for the well-heeled set too, right? There were no cheap tickets on the Concorde. Those seats were all first class. I think it's interesting to think that we might that's the kind of leap we're talking about too, isn't it? Because this is as who said it in the chat room. This is we go from supersonic to Sally says hypersonic. That's exactly right. I mean, we're talking about going way fast now. We're talking about going it's suborbital, but I assume we're still talking about something over probably 10,000-15,000 miles an hour, something like that. You'd have to be going 17,000 miles an hour to go into orbit. But yeah, talk about the rocket set. Have you caught Pan Am at all? The show on ABC.
I have not. What is it good? I've been kind of meaning to.
It's from my standpoint, it's great to watch for the look and feel. I mean, to me, it's interesting because of the clothes they wear and just the planes are interesting, and just the whole culture of the airline is kind of interesting to watch. I've only watched the pilot episode. I don't know that I'll be watching it regularly or anything, but if you look at the if you look at the flying experience then and the flying experience today, back then it was the absolute cutting edge of technology, and it was for the, as you said, well-heeled. I think that's a good way of putting it. And it was a luxury experience. It was what Virginia Postrel would describe as a glamorous experience. You know, and today, flying on a jet aircraft, by and large, for most of us, most of the time, is like being on a really uncomfortable bus that goes way fast, right? I mean, it's like...
exactly.
You know,
and the process of getting onto the aircraft is not glamorous, I can tell you that. You know, having to take off your shoes.
Nothing about it, you know?
Yeah, and, I mean, you know, if you're unlucky, you might get pulled aside to have,
There's that whole thing. But even, you know, even after you get through all that humiliation, you look at these clippers that they're flying in Pan Am and these big, you know, big spacious seats, and they had little lounge areas. You know, you could walk up to the front of the plane, there'd be a little table, you could just sit down. I mean, you know, today on an airplane, every space that can be a seat is a seat, and every seat that they can put a butt in, they put a butt in, right? And,
yep.
You know, and you are packed in there like sardines, and I think that what's going to happen here with something like this, with the space plane, is that we bring the glamour back to travel, and the rocket age, the rocket set are going to be the new glamour travels. The new Pan Am will be people traveling through space to get to their destination. So I welcome that. I think we're just about out of time here, aren't we?
We're getting close. All right. Well, should we go ahead with the music? Maybe perhaps allow the our live listeners to actually hear the music.
Let them hear some of the music. What do we got tonight?
Okay. It is Live in the Sky by Shorter.
Well, perfect. We end with Live in the Sky after talking about rocket planes. All right. So, but Shorter singing Live in the Sky. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us. Great chat this evening. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week. And until then, live to see it.
you want the truth, it's not gonna change. I never wanted you to walk out there and stop